Okay, at this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Sam S. from San Diego. Welcome. Nice to have you here once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Sam, and I am an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Yes. Okay, great. Thank you. I'm glad to be here tonight. I want to thank Tom to call me, and then he's got the flu tonight. He texts me, but I want to thank him for asking me to come down here. I have been here before several years ago, and it's good to be back. I have a lot of respect for this place and this room, and you know, the walls here have helped a lot of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And as an alcoholic, I was out there for a long time, and the book talks about the alcoholic who suffers. And that's an alcoholic like me. I didn't know there is a way out. So I have a lot of value for the chair, which I sit on it in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. As much as AA, especially in Southern California, it's fashionable. Everybody goes to AA, but not everybody knows about it. I drank in Chicago, and I didn't know anything about AA. The only AA I knew in Chicago was American Airlines. That's all you knew. So, and I'm glad that, you know, at the meetings they introduced me, Sam from San Diego. So I'm sure there are some people sitting over there, they say, this guy doesn't sound like from San Diego. I don't even sound from, I'm not even from the state of California. And I come from East. And I'm not talking about New York. I was born in Tehran, Iran. And it seems that I'm sure that everybody, you know, these days, you're all over there, even if you don't watch the news. But anyhow, before 1979, which the revolution happened, it was a completely different country. And a lot of people are younger people, you know, they cannot imagine. It was like a Western country, Western city. We had bars, we had discotheques, we had nightclubs, we had miniskirts. And all these things, you know, but after 79, it changed. And that's where I grew up until I was about 22 years old. And, you know, I grew up in a house. My father was a high-ranking officer in the military, in Shaw's military at that time. And that's how our house was run. He was the general. My mother was second in command. I had three younger sisters. Me and my sisters were E1s. We did not count at all. But later on, I found out that, you know, my mother was the general. My father was a second in command. Let's put it this way. My parents, they had really high hopes for me. They wanted me to become engineer, doctor, or something. They sent me to really good schools back there. And I studied a lot. I was a loner because I had to study a lot. I read a lot of books. I didn't like mix with the other kids that much. And I didn't know none of these things until I got sober. I thought that's the way everybody is. And I went to good schools, and it was such a big deal at that time over there to, when you graduate from high school to get to university. We had limited universities even at that time. And when I graduated from high school, one of the most famous high schools in Tehran, with a really good average, then there were about 250,000 high school graduates, and only you had to take a national exam to get to university. And only 11,000 would get to universities. So the competition was high. And when I took that exam and I passed and I got to university, it's like a lot of pressure was taken away from me. that my parents, they thought that, hey, I made it up, I'm going to be on my way to become what they wanted me to be. And you know, talking about that, even I carried that, even through my sobriety when I was 3 years sober, that I always thought that I'm supposed to do what I'm ought to do. I didn't know what I'm supposed, I didn't know that, hey, I can do something which I want to. I thought I'm supposed to do, I mean, I'm supposed to go to school, I'm supposed to study. You know, I didn't know when my sponsor asked me, I was a few years sober, that I says, I want to change jobs. And he says, so what do you want to do? And I look at him like, what do you mean? He says, what is it that you want to do? And it's like, you know, I didn't know what has had to do with anything, like, you know, what I want to do. It was always what I ought to do. That's how I was brought up. And, you know, I was maybe, a couple years sober, a few years sober, that I just suddenly, just dawned on me that it's like the last time I remember was like, you know, when I was like 14, 15 years old, you know. From that time to like all my adulthood, I had sleepwalked. I could not remember. Suddenly I found myself in Chicago with a wife, with a beautiful wife and a son. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, God, how did I get here? And there used to be a song with the older people, you know, they remember the young people, they don't buy talking heads. You know, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here? So after I passed that exam and I got through college back home, pressure was gone. And I started drinking because everybody was drinking at college. And, you know, my drinking started like this, that there was a liquor store right by the campus. And it was a bar and liquor store. And they opened at 8 o'clock in the morning. And at 8:30, I stopped by that place, and I had seen the movies that how, like, the stars, they drink, and I would order a tall glass of vodka with nothing in it, no ice or anything. And we cupped a couple olives next to it as a wash. It's 8:30 in the morning, and I downed that because that's, I saw the movies, that's how people drank, with a couple olives. And as soon as I get out of that liquor store, there was an alley right behind it. And I go to the alley and throw my guts out. But when it stayed in and I didn't throw it out, it felt all right. And I loved the feeling. I go to classes drunk. I was like a darling at the campus. You know, everybody, as I was the student senator, I hang around with religious people. I hang around with leftist people. I almost pick up machine gun and joined the underground guerrillas. At that time, we had a lot of demonstrations going against the Shah, and everybody who was at college at that time was a kind of political. And I'm trying to say a little bit the contradictions here. When I was 16 years old, back home, I became an Orthodox Muslim. I wouldn't even go to movies. I wouldn't even watch TV. I go to mosque almost every day, and my parents were not religion at all. And somehow when I got to college, university, you start getting books, you know, the philosophy, and I started reading. I was interested in materialism, philosophy, and then I became like a socialist or something like that. And then later on, you know, when I started drinking, God knows what I was. I was mixed up of everything. But what alcohol did when I was drinking at college, it was the greatest social lubricant for me. I could do anything I wanted to. Again, I was hanging around, all the crowds, they loved me. People would get classes with me because I was funny, I would make everybody laugh. And somehow I managed to get my degree. I started physics. And I started talking about, I know it's an AA meeting, but I started smoking pot in college. And believe it or not, the main reason I started smoking pot was because when I smoked pot, it made my eyes a kind of red and small, and I thought it made me look more romantic. So I managed to get a degree, a bachelor's degree in physics, somehow. And then it was customary over there because we didn't have, we had education, higher education, but not that many. And because my parents were well off, you know, that I landed in Chicago. And that was in 1976. And I went to University of Illinois at Chicago. A year later, my college sweetheart came here. I was a physicist, she was a biologist, you know, she came here, we got married, everything looked good. And I was drinking, I could manage everything. I had, teaching some laboratories at the university, I didn't have to pay tuition. And the same thing with my wife, she started, studying, and God gave us a son. I love children. When I had a son, it's the best thing that happened to me. But my drinking gradually got worse and worse. And, you know, we had a neighborhood bar. I lived in the suburb of Chicago called Berwyn, right by Cicero, if anybody knows about Chicago. And then, I don't know how people become alcoholics in San Diego. I mean, 2 o'clock in the morning, everything is closed. You know, in Chicago, the bars are open until 4 o'clock in the morning, on the weekends, 5 o'clock. Then we close the bar, we go to the suburbs like Cicero, and the bars are open 24 hours, you know. The bartenders were my best friends. When we closed the bars, I drank, you know, with bartenders and the bar owners, I would stick around. And so the drinking got bad. I could still manage to go, you know, to teach and then go to get my degrees. I got a master's degree in physics after a couple of years, and I started working on my PhD program in physics. And this is when my drinking got really bad. And I spent about 5 years in that program. And there is, anybody is familiar with this kind of programs, there is a qualifying exam you have to pass for your PhD. And it is a hard, hard exam. That's an exam that maybe people for 2 years study for it. And after you pass all the graduate level courses. And like every good alcoholic, I says, I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to just not, and I know it, and I do it. And I went to that exam. I know this much. The night before, I was drunk. When I went to the exam the next day, it's a 5 days exam. It's very hard. And I flunked that exam. And the first thing came to my mind is they don't understand what a great scientist I am. So later on, I changed fields, and I went to the same university. I went to study to get another master's degree in metallurgical engineering. And the only reason I say that, I'm not trying to say all these degrees or something, that later on, when alcohol kicked my behind, I don't want to use it, you're taping this, so. Although later on, maybe you might regret the taping it, you know, who knows. But it was so baffling for me. With all the degrees I had, all the knowledge I had, I could not stop drinking, man. That was just like, you know, I mean, I couldn't figure it out. And again, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous until I came, you know, many years later when I got sober. So I they gave me a laboratory, and I'm working on something called low temperature, you know, high corrosion of ceramics, high temperature of ceramics. And I have a laboratory to my own, and I have unlimited glassware in that laboratory, and I run experiments. You know, this is where my drinking got so bad that my wife, we were separated, me and my wife, and I was on my own. And I used to go to the bars and then come to the, you know, I told the university police that I run the experiments. I had the key to get the science and building and check my experiments. And, you know, it says that every 2 hours I have to check on it. And this laboratory really looks like a Frankenstein movie with all this glassware, which is the acid is bubbling through it. It's for calibration of gases. you know, and I had an unlimited source of glassware and test tubes, everything. And this was the time that I was introduced again. I know it's an AA meeting, but as far as drugs goes, I did drugs only once from 1970. From 1977 to 1987, continuously. I never stopped. So this is the time that somehow I got introduced to cocaine, and they called it at that time something, we call it freebasing. We didn't have all these designer drugs. And that really, I mean, that was my downfall really fast. It allowed me to drink as much as I could. I literally loved it. Not that much the drugs, but because it made me the capacity to drink a lot, you know, to party all night, to stay out all night. So I come to my lab because at 3-4 o'clock in the morning from the bars, and then I party and then I drink and I do whatever I need to do in my laboratory. And so I have all this glassware. And I'm now introduced, you know, this is about the, you know, having test tubes to make freebasing and to cook the cocaine and to smoke it. And every night I do this, and then until 7 o'clock in the morning before the janitors came in or the graduate students. And I was getting paranoid at that time, a lot in my lab. So it came to a point that at 7 o'clock in the morning, I could not. If I knew you were going to tape this shit, I would not talk about this stuff. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, the other graduate students come in and other, you know, people are coming in. And it came to a point that after 7 o'clock, I could not drink in the morning. So with the scientific mind I have, I came up with this great idea, because I was working with toxic gases, chlorine and other stuff to produce the environment for my experiments. So I ordered a fume hood for my laboratory, which looked like something the same size of this, exactly these two windows next to each other, and is about 4 feet, you know, deep. And it had a glass door which you could open it. And the top of it was a really powerful exhaust going all the way to the roof of the science and engineering building. And because I was working with toxic glasses, the purpose was, you know, when I'm working with the toxic glasses, I can put it inside that chamber and put, you know, that, you know, that nobody gets hurt. The main purpose of it was because older people, if you remember, if you are doing freebasing, that thing is like a lot of smoke in the lab. And then 7 o'clock, people are coming in, you know, what am I going to do with this? So I would ask graduate students to go out, do something for me. And I opened a fume hood with my pipe, and I stick my head in there and do whatever I needed to do. That fume hood cost the taxpayers $20,000. I can talk about it because I already made my amends and I paid for it. That's how far off I was. The only reason I talked maybe about these things is how far I was from reality, how delusional I was, and I didn't know that. And it got to a point my drinking so bad that, I am supposed to have publications, you know, write publications, and, you know, I was going to two boxes of test tubes every week, you know, and, anyhow. So again, I lost my job over there. I didn't have anything. And then my parents lived in San Diego. And I had got money from anybody which I could get money from. And then my mother called and, you know, she wanted to see me for the last time. She was crazy. It's a long story anyhow. And my dad, which was I used to talk to him like, sir. I would not, you could not talk. He was a tough guy. And I remember he came to Chicago from San Diego and I met him at the airport. And he says, your mother is dying. She wants to see you. And I says, did you bring me some money, any money? She says, no, but I came to take you with me. And I just, exactly like this, I says, get the hell out of here. And I left the airport. And then, anyhow, a few days later, my mother called and says, I just want to see you once. And I'm like, you don't understand. I have laboratory. I'm doing research for University of Illinois, and I'm doing all these things, you know. I can't come to San Diego. So she promised me only for one day. They sent me a round-trip ticket for 24 hours. I had a BMW, which I parked. I owed a lot of money on it to credit unions. And I parked it at O'Hare Airport, and I flew to San Diego. The next time I went back to Chicago was 4 years later when I had 3 years of sobriety. So I came to San Diego, and I had nothing. The wife is gone. I mean, my son, which was the most important person in my life, you know, he was in San Diego with my wife. And, you know, I couldn't understand. Why is it that, you know, my wife was saying that, you know, you're okay, like during the weekdays, but Friday night, Saturday night, I was out. And I didn't know. I love my wife. I mean, this is the whole thing, that I didn't want to lose my wife. I didn't want to lose my job. I didn't want to lose my son, but I was a slave to King Alcohol. I did everything for alcohol. And this was, again, because I had such a big head about all these degrees, it really, I couldn't figure out that. Why is it that I cannot stop drinking with all my knowledge? I didn't know. My knowledge is not going to help me. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I came to San Diego and in 1987, and I had lost everything. I got a job in, like, you know, some company in sales, and I was a research scientist, but I started making really good money. So I was back at it. I was top producer for the company. The owner of the company called me, and I thought nobody knew that I'm making so much money for the company. And I had a company car. He asked me to, you know, he called me in his office. His son had gone, his 19-year-old son had gone to McDonald's Center at that time, which was in Scripps Hospital, the treatment center, and had got out and OD'd in the bathroom of their house and died. So he says, give me the key for your demo, your car. And he says, we have talked to McDonald's Center. You're going to go over there. You're an asset to our company, but you're going to die. And I'm so grateful. And I didn't know what treatment center I was. You know, at that time, I thought if they can get me away from alcohol and drugs, even for 30 days, 28 days, maybe I get my head clear. I don't know if I'm sure somebody can relate to this. At the end, I wasn't getting drunk. I wasn't getting high. And no matter how much I drank, no matter how much I did, I just couldn't get it. And I was, you know, and I couldn't leave it alone. This thing about the baffling feature of alcohol is alcohol, that I just couldn't leave it alone, even if it wasn't doing much for me at the end. When it was working fine, it was fine. So I went to treatment center for 28 days, and over there they took us to the meetings. And that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow I heard something at the meeting which I felt I don't have to drink. I don't have to live that way anymore. There is a way out. And that's why I say I have so much value for my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, because not everybody knows about AA. I was educated, and I was an educator in Chicago. I didn't know nothing about AA until somehow I ended up in a treatment center. So, and then I got out of the treatment center. I got busy. I had a sponsor right away. And I start getting commitments, and I start going to meetings. And I mean, today is January the 4th, it's holidays. First of all, happy holidays, everybody. You know, I was a few months sober, and everybody in meetings was talking about the miracles of AA. And I'm like, the first year is really hard. If you're in your first year, I mean, the first year of sobriety is very, very hard, because, you know, we got to get a lot of things together. And I'm sitting at the meetings thinking about, God, everybody's talking about miracles. When is the miracle going to happen for me? Then it just dawned on me that I was brought up in a Muslim country. I got sober on Christmas Day, and my first sponsor was a Jew. I have not looked for miracles ever since. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean, I did a lot of things here which didn't make sense. AA to me is a no-nonsense program. When told me for the first 10 years of my sobriety, there was a meeting in La Jolla speakers, which my job was to mop the floor after everybody left. It was a big hall at that time, 600 people. And it was wooden floor. They pick up the chairs. And I used to, then after everybody, at that time, a lot of people smoked. And then in the parking lot, because the next day, Sunday morning, they had the church's services, my job was, after I mopped the floor, to go pick, they gave me a coffee can to go pick up cigarette butts in the parking lot. And I go pick up cigarette butts in the parking lot. And I start soaring at everybody, from to higher power to my sponsor, how insensitive this guy is. That, I gotta go back to Chicago to get my wife back, to get my son back. I gotta go back, get my job back, teaching job back. Why am I doing these things here? But this is the thing. When I got here, old timers used to say something: either you are done with drinking or you are not done. And I was hurting so bad when I got here. I was done drinking. Everything I did in AA, every direction I took, the main reason for it was because I didn't want to drink no more. And so I used to go, pick up the cigarette box. Then I go home and I used to, this alcoholist, God knows what kind of other diseases they have. I used to wash my hands like with alcohol, with bleach and everything 100,000 times, but I did it because somehow at that time it was necessary and it kept me sober. When I made amends, sending child support to my son, all these things which I didn't want to do at that time, when I was about 8-9 months sober, we came to making amends, or other people. But I did it not because I wanted to be a good father or a good son, a good person. The main reason was because I did not want to drink no more. I just wanted to stay sober more than anything. I knew that after revolution, that they closed the bars, alcohol is prohibited, but everybody's drinking. Let me tell you this. It's like the prohibition time here, that when you tell people something not to do, they're going to do it a lot more. They want to do it. And I knew drugs and alcohol is, the way I have heard about back home, is taking the whole young generation out. Because people have nothing to do. There's no movies or, nightclub or anything. They get together and they drink and they do drugs in their houses. So about 20 years ago, I went back home. And at that time, I had 11 years sober. We had NA. We had one AA meeting, which mostly NA people were coming to. And the big book was translated about 24 years ago, the first 164 pages, taken back there with some guys from Los Angeles, a couple guys. So, but because drugs were so dominant over there, everybody even, they had the first 164 pages of the AA book, but NA was doing big over there. Everybody was related to NA. So we started an AA meeting in the holy city of Mashhad, the holiest city in Iran, which is close to Afghanistan border, and with about 12, 13 people. In a big book study. And I travel back there every year for about 4 or 5 weeks. And because they didn't have 12 by 12 by that time, they didn't have long-term sobriety, they didn't know how to do the steps. So I travel different cities when I go over there. And I set up step study workshops. 2 or 3 days. When I do it nowadays, it's about between 4,000 or 5,000 people show up for the workshops. We have over 25,000 members in AA right now over there. We have meetings all over the country. And I used to go back the first couple of years, I used to come back home and tell my sponsor, they're gonna close the meetings, like, you know, that women and men, you know, they're not sitting up, you know, over there. It's a Muslim country, like, you know, you're not supposed to be in the same room or something even. But I was, you know, so worried about that, if AA is gonna stay there or not. And my sponsor, God love him, at that time told me something which to this day I use that. He says, Sam, if God wants AA to be in Iran, AA is gonna be there. And that helped me a lot. So AA meeting is the only place that men and women, they sit next to each other over there. In a Muslim country. There is an Orthodox, these are fanatics Muslims, right? But it comes to AA, they have, you know, it's amazingly, they have an open mind because they say it works. I think it was the 4th or 5th year which I was going there. And then in the city of Mashhad, they rented like a big stadium. And I spoke over there. The next day, they asked me to go to the governor's office. And I had an entourage, 5, 6 people, alcoholics with me. So we go over there, and the guy says, he was the deputy of governor, or, you know. He says, we know you flew from capital at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you got here. He says, by 6 p.m., you guys had about 3,500 people in that stadium, which was the capacity for that big hall. And 1,500, and then outside the room, the hall, we had closed circuit TVs. And he says there were about 1,500 people outside. How did you get all these people in one place at such a short time? And over there, to get more than 5 people, you have to have government's permission. They won't allow the crowd. And then he says, what do you guys give these people? Free blanket, free food or something? And they are, so, and this is the thing. There was not even one scuffle. The guy was amazed. Nobody has raised his voice, all these people over there. Then, so I start talking to them about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were interested because they say it works. We didn't know what to do. Before that, when I went to Iran, it was like, you know, they said, if there was posters, big posters in the squares in the cities, it says an addict is a criminal. And they didn't know what to do with them. You know, one morning you come in, and they had the government, you know, the stuff was coming from themselves. You know, they put some cut in the heroin, and you come in, 200 people, addicts were dead. Something they OD'd, you know. So, and they were like, you know, hey, you know, this is working, we are fine with it. They told us, hey, we have a budget for you guys. We have the Department of Health and Ministry, you know, which you can, you know, is gonna, you know, we can give you money. Then when we told them we have a 7th tradition, we are self-supporting through our own contributions. You should see the guy's face. What do you mean? You don't want money? No. We asked them, just give us rooms for the meetings. So the same way we have meetings here in churches, in the parks, recreational centers, over there we have meetings in the mosques because it's much cheaper to rent a room in a mosque than outside or something, you know, that do. And, you know, people here, they ask me, how are the meetings over there? And over there, they're asking me, the guys, how are the meetings over here? It's the same thing. You know, here I go, the meetings in the church, we have the cross or, you know, the statues of Jesus. Over there, we go to the mosque, we have the pictures of Ayatollahs. And, you know, the names are different. Here we have John, Jay, Mary, Tom. Over there, we have Ali, you know, Babak, other names. But they talk about Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, and 12 Steps. It's the same thing over there. So, you know, I had gone to a meeting in the west of Iran. There are mountains called Zagros Mountains, west side of Iran. And the people over there are mostly Kurdish. And they live in high mountains, small villages up there. Even the Revolutionary Guards, they don't dare to go up there. I mean, these guys are tough. They still have their Colts they carry. So there was a meeting in this small village. We go over there, and then the head of the village is the leader of the meeting. And the topic of the meeting is the change we do because of the steps. So the guy goes, I mean, and they got a different accent, you know. I mean, I wish somehow I could relay that accent in my English, so you know how it sounded, you know, that. But anyhow, he's like, he says, you know, he was going to say about how much he has changed since he worked the steps. He says, before I got sober, when I get up in the morning and I come out through my barn, and my mule is there, and when my mule sees me, shakes his head and smiles at me. He said, since I got sober and I did the steps, I have changed so much that in the morning when I come out and I see my mule does not recognize me anymore. You know, we talk about change. I'd like to welcome to the newcomers here, and congratulations on the 3 years. That's wonderful. I want to say a little bit about my experience with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. You know, the book on page 17 talks about we have a common solution. Talks about the passengers of a great liner, and then on the bottom and the bottom of the book talks about we have a so if we have a common solution, we must have a common problem. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I'm thinking about what is the common problem here we have here. I mean, I go to meetings. When people talk about problems, you know, about drinking, is like, man, when I drank, I couldn't stop drinking. I kept drinking. Or I did this when I drank, I got to the jail. I went to jail. I lost this. I got DUI. I got three of them. I got five of them. All these things are funny stories. So I thought that, you know, well, the problem is when I drink, I cannot stop drinking, and I do all these crazy things. So that obviously, maybe it made sense to me. So my sponsor says no. The phenomenon of craving has, or AA has nothing to do with phenomenon of craving. That is not what six years ago or something, you know, AA came with, you know. I mean, my sponsor says, Aristotle's grandmother knew that the guy, the alcoholist, he falls off the wagon, he cannot not drink, and he's going to drink. And the phenomenon of craving is not mentioned in the book, only in doctor's opinion. The rest of the book doesn't talk about phenomenon of craving. And I used to go tell my sponsor, well, I mean, this is what I hear at the meetings. People talk about when they drank, they did all these crazy things. And that's all we say. He says, that is not the insanity of alcohol. He says, that's the ordinary neurosis, our craziness, made me drink. So, this is only my experience with my sponsor. I have a sponsor, which is an ex-priest, Irishman, by the name of Seamus. And that figures. So, if you look at, and I used to ask him, so what is it? I mean, the people I hear that people in the meetings, you know, all the time, when he talks about the insanity of alcohol, they talk about how insane they become when they had a drink. So he, if you look at the book, on page 21 and 22, it says, what about the real alcoholic? Which is a great description of an alcoholic. About Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde when we drink. We gotta be, we drink around the clock. We get tight exactly at the wrong moment. You know, we build up something, you know. It talks about greatly what happens when we drink on those two pages. It's a long paragraph. But on the page 23, on the top of page 23, it goes like this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink to set up the terrible in motion. And therefore, the main problem of alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So after here, page 23, is all about, the book talks about the insanity of sober alcoholic, not drinking alcohol, not the guy who is drinking. And for a long time, I thought all these things the book is talking about. You know, if you're new, please, even if you already have been around, chapter 2, there is a solution. And more about alcoholism is magnificent. You get, I mean, the way these guys, they have described alcoholism, which nobody has ever done in mankind's history, is just mind-boggling. When we read it, we see exactly what it's talking about. So then he comes in, like, you know, on page 24. It talks about, it says in italic, for reasons yet obscure, alcoholics, they have lost the power of choice in drink. My mind is not capable to bring with sufficient force the memory or humiliation or suffering of a week before or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink, and I'd like to add this, sober. Not when I was drinking. When I'm sober, I'm powerless over alcohol. It's funny when I go to meetings. I mean, I'm just talking about, you know, it's my opinion, it's just my understanding. When people say, don't drink no matter what. Man, I drink no matter what. That is not the solution, don't drink no matter what. That's my problem. You're stating a problem, not the solution. Oh, go to meetings and don't drink. Thank you. Then what the hell am I doing here, standing here? Why do I need this if I could do that? You know, my problem is, and the book is great about it. It talks about on the top of page 35. You know, this is, I'm going to tell you this. My sponsor told me, Sam, this book is like a treasure map. And I'm like, okay. He says, on a treasure map, where do they hide the treasure usually? And I says, he says, do you know? And I says, well, it shows, he says, how does it show on the treasure map where the treasure is? And I says, they put like an X on it. He says, yeah. Okay, they put an X on the treasure. That's where the treasure is, on the treasure map. So the book is like a treasure map. Go find the treasure. And man, I'm like, doesn't he know who I am? I mean, I have all this year's sobriety. I worked with so many people. I mean, I read the book so many times, you know, upside down, and, you know, I don't know. And I look through the book, and I can't find the X. So he says, bring your book. on the top of page 35, it says, we shall describe some of the mental states which precedes a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. He says, don't you think the crux of the problem is important? And I hadn't seen it until that time. And he talks about the mental states which precedes a relapse into drinking, not what happens to me after drinking. And he gives you some great stories. The guy, Jim, he owns an automobile, lucrative automobile or something. He loses his business, and he has been to an insane asylum, and he has lost everything. And he's 7 months sober, Jim. And he goes to a cafe, to find a customer and orders a sandwich, right? And a glass of milk. Everybody knows that? Yeah. The guy is 7 months sober, and he has lost everything. He says, suddenly the thought came to my mind that if I put an ounce of whiskey in a glass of milk on a full stomach, it is not going to hurt me. That's exactly how we are. I could be sober, and somebody pushes a drink around my way. This thing, a few pages later, talks about it. The best one is this guy, Fred. Fred is an accountant, and he goes to Washington for some business. And Fred is 11 months sober. And he says, my business, he was in a hotel, he says, my business came up well. I mean, this is, the word insanity, which the book talks about it, it says, parallel with our sound reasoning runs this peculiar phenomenon, twisted phenomenon, that, we find an excuse to picking up a drink. And which is, this insane idea, which we get to drink. And then this is the word I like. It's not that we have the insane idea. It says the insane idea won out. The insane idea always wins. So that's our problem. So this guy has gone to Washington and 11 months sober. And insanity is something that you cannot describe it. If you want to describe it, then it's not insanity. Because psychologists really have a hard time with, look at this guy. If this guy, he goes to a psychologist, is going to tell him, hey, maybe you were out of town before. The book says, the guy says, no, I have been out of town during this period of dry spell before. Maybe you weren't feeling good. The guy says, I was feeling really good. Maybe your business didn't come off well. The guy is saying, says, my business came off well. I knew I would be happy, my partners would be happy. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. I come down the hotel lobby, and suddenly the thought came to my mind, a couple cocktails would be great right now. That is the insanity Alcoholics Anonymous is talking about, the insanity of sober alcoholic. Then the next page, he talks about that the guy says, I realize that self-knowledge has nothing to do with those strange, blank mental spots. So we have a strange, blank mental spots. Doesn't matter, I'm a year sober, 20 years sober, 30 years sober, somebody can push a drink and it just comes out like a good idea. I can have a drink today. That when I realized that, I was really scared. Then I really worked the program, because it talks about, then I realized what the powerlessness is. Then I realized what it means that I'm powerless over this stuff. Then I realized what the book on page 45 talks about, that lack of power is my dilemma. I need to find a power greater than myself. That there is between me and drink, that is only that power. and there is not, you know, there is nothing. And this is the next line is great, which we don't talk about it. This is exactly what this book is about. To allow you to find a power greater than yourself. And then later on he talks about, somehow I had to give up all these things I knew about God or religion or anything because I was looking for it outside myself. But the book talks about, he says, deep down in every man, woman, and child, not every alcoholic, every man, woman, and child is fundamental idea of God. It is only there you can find it. And I was trying to pray to look at the sky or something like that to find it. You know, it's the book says it's inside us. Jesus says, it's not me, not I, but the Father in me. And Muhammad says, God is closer to you than the vein in your neck. Now, somehow we are looking for it, you know, well, people, they talk about, well, I'm looking, you know, this higher power. I know it is not me or in me or something like that. No, it is. You are the extension of God. You are His extension. And the 12 by 12 on page 40 of the 12 by 12, the last paragraph, I think the one to the last paragraph of the third step. If I can remember, it goes like this, that our whole problem have been the misuse of our willpower. We have bombarded our problems with it. So here, the third step is the beginning to bring my will in agreement, in alignment with God's will and intention for me. And then he says, that is the purpose of the 12 steps. And I thought the purpose of the steps was for me to stay sober and carry the message. That's the goal. The goal and the purpose are two different things. So the purpose of the 12 steps is for us to bring my will aligned with God's will. How do we do that? On page 84 of our book, I mean, we talk about in the second step about the insanity. Came to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity, right? And I really like, you know, I want to say a little bit, you know, I know I have a couple of minutes, you know, I try to wrap it up in less than 5 minutes. In the book, you know, that second step is somehow we read it like, you know, I was reading it that came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And sponsors, they really torture their sponsees with this step. You're on your second week. You haven't found God yet. It's like a treatment center. The chart says you must be in your second step right now, and you must be God. You must be in your life or something. It doesn't say that in the second step. We keep, you know, we have to look at the book, our book, in the whole context, not take some parts of it. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It doesn't say came to believe in a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That means there is a proposition right after that, that, you know, I come to the meetings, the second step. I see you people are sitting here, they are telling me they are sober. I say, if it works for you, it's gonna work for me. Boom. That's the second step. I don't need to dwell on it, I don't need to look for anything or anybody. But the insanity here we talk about, which I talk about it, on page 84 of our book, the book is full of promises. You know, that, you know, the promises on page 83 or something is not the best one. You know, there's a lot more promises here. It says, we have ceased fighting everything and everybody. By this time, the sanity will have returned. We recoil from it like a hot flame. and it comes automatically. We do the steps. This is right after step 10. I don't have to fight it. I don't have to not drinking no matter what. I don't have to, like, you know, it's not, it just comes automatically. So it says we have ceased fighting everything and everybody. Everything and everybody. That's a big sentence. The translation of that sentence is surrender. I have to surrender. And what do I surrender to? We surrender to the will of God. So the word Muslim means somebody who surrenders to the will of God. They don't have good reputations. But if you want to be a good alcoholic, I guess you must be a good Muslim also. The will, the word, and how do I surrender to the will of God? Whatever happens at this moment or any moment, we surrender to the will of God by accepting it. Whatever. Acceptance means I accept whatever event happens in my life at that moment without judging it. As soon as I judge it, it's got to the ego. It's not acceptance, it's tolerance. I hear a lot of acceptance at the meetings, but it's, I don't like it, but I'm going to accept it. That's not acceptance, that's tolerance. Acceptance is before you judge it. And when you do that, when we accept whatever happens in your life, when you accept that, because it's happening because life or God, your higher power is sending it. There is a reason for it. This is happening. If we can train ourselves to accept that moment without any, the resistance is zero, without any judgment, you open a space inside you. And that space which you open, we allow God or your higher power or life to come in and do the right thing, to flow in. And when I resist, my heart is clenching. Nothing can go through it. I mean, when opening the space, I mean, isn't that the main reason we meditate? Meditation, the purpose of meditation is, you know, that my thoughts are like a continuous spectrum. They go right after each other, and I see them like continuous thoughts. You know, I mean, if you're like me, and then the whole, but there are different thoughts going on, which, because I think so fast, I don't see different thoughts. I see, like, you know, it's like, boom, a straight line going on. The whole purpose of meditation is that when one thought is finished, another thought is going to start. But my mind doesn't allow me to see that. So when we meditate, we open this slit. We open the thought between the two thoughts, whatever it is. That's how the purpose of meditation. And it's not that stop thinking, but if you open this space, that's where your higher power is. That's what the creativity is. That's what the intuition is. So this is the same thing. When I accept the moment and I open the space, I allow God to come in and do whatever he's supposed to do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so, so grateful that somehow I got lucky. I got the privilege of having the disease of alcoholism. This is the best movement in contemporary mankind. And I'm so grateful to be a very tiny, tiny part of it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Sam. That was awesome. Whew. Okay, we would like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a great dinner tonight. And if you round up, we'll close with a prayer.
Anymore.